It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This coming Monday, General Michael Hayden, former director of the Central Intelligence Agency and the National Security Agency, is appearing in Pittsburgh to take part in a World Affairs Council public policy discussion and luncheon, the title of which is Security, Privacy, Surveillance, and You. General Hayden is a Pittsburgh native who holds degrees from Duquesne University. He is currently a principal at the Chertoff Group, a security consultancy co-founded by former Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff, and a distinguished visiting professor at George Mason University. He joins us by phone from Virginia. General Hayden, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks very much, Paul. Happy to be with you.
And if you would like to join the conversation, you can call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address is ESSPGH@WESA.FM, and you can reach us on Twitter at ESSPGH and follow the conversation at #EPLive. Again, if you have a comment or question for our guest, General Michael Hayden, 412-246-2002, the number to call. General Hayden, I'm not sure if the timing of this discussion could be much better. We have the controversy from the NSA contractor-turned-exile Edward Snowden's leaking of details related to U.S. government-led programs and the NSA program that caused an uproar both in the United States and abroad. And today, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that the CIA is amassing a huge database of international money transfers that includes the financial and personal data of millions of Americans. What can you tell us about this and why it is being done?
Sure. There are lots of reasons why this is being done or things like this are being done. The one in the foreground is terrorism. But Paul, people like myself who have been in government and people attempting to comment on this need to have a broader view, too. I mean, there are dangers out there beyond terrorism. And so to narrowly justify these programs simply because of the 9/11 attacks or a threat of a repeat of those attacks, I think would be a mistake. But that said, a good deal of what Snowden has revealed and what it appears this current story in the Wall Street Journal reveals does indeed have to do with terrorism. And I can very, very briefly kind of give you the approach we had right after 9/11.
Sure.
Here was an enemy, unlike the one we had faced in the Cold War, all right? And we actually had almost a mantra that the difference between this war and the Cold War was that, you know, in facing another powerful nation state, the enemy was easy to find. He was just hard to stop. Now, in the current war, the one against Al-Qaeda, he's actually easy to stop. He's just really, really hard to find. And so this has become, at its base, an intelligence war. If you get the intelligence right, everything else pretty much falls into place. And so what we had to do was to track down those people who would will us harm. And we had a simple approach. Follow the stuff, follow the people, follow the money. Those were the three things, the stuff being chemical weapons or arms or precursor materials. Follow the people, people we knew who were or were affiliated with Al-Qaeda. And then finally, follow the money. And if we pulled on those threads, we generally found what we were looking for, the plot that intended harm to ourselves and to our friends. So I don't know the details of the Wall Street Journal story, but I certainly can tell you that following the money was a very important part of how we work to identify those who are already committed to come and kill us.
How is this type of program authorized? Is it legal? And even if it is, as far as you're concerned, is it ethical, especially when Americans aren't even aware that it's happening?
That's a great question. And, of course, I wouldn't have done it if I didn't think it were legal and ethical. And, you know, I was involved in many of these kinds of programs. Now, Paul, you and my fellow Pittsburghers have to understand, I've been out of government now almost 5 years. And so I lack detailed specific knowledge on some things. But, you know, truth be told, there are parallels between, I'm sure, what's going on now and what I did. Look, here's the way we looked at it. And this is a really important thing I think I want to share with my friends in Pittsburgh. You know, the government gives us a box within which to work, all right? And that box is the box formed by the limits of law and policy. And in our constitutional system, there are a variety of ways that the box gets created. I mean, from time to time, that box is created by almost raw presidential power. It comes out of the executive branch under his Article II authorities. At other times, it's from the two political branches, the president and the Congress acting together. And there are other times where you've got the president, the Congress, and the courts all in agreement. And so, for example, the most recent NSA stories, you know, they go by the shorthand of the 215 program. That's all that telephone metadata, you know, your calls and mine.
Mm-hmm.
And the 702 program, the PRISM, that's the foreign email program. Every one of those programs was authorized by the president, and I should add two really different presidents, but they both authorized it. It both have been approved in statute by both houses of Congress and both political parties, and both are overseen by the FISA court. Now, that's almost the Madisonian trifecta when it comes to the three different branches of our government agreeing on what's effective, lawful, and appropriate for national defense. Now, Paul, that what I just said to you is the grand compromise that came out of the intelligence scandals and crises of the 1970s. We involved our Congress, and we involved our courts in intelligence activities in ways that, frankly, no other Western democracy has done. The current debate's a bit new. There's a different kind of flavor there. It's suggested by one of the elements of the question you asked about the people not knowing. And so are we moving into a place now that our society, in order to have the quote-unquote consent of the governed for these kinds of espionage activities, are we now moving to a place where it's insufficient, where our representative government makes these decisions, and we have to more or less push them in the direction of a plebiscite? That's a really interesting question, and it's actually kind of behind some of the positions that some people seem to be taking these days.
Well, you make a very good point, sir, and I guess part of what this comes back to is the constitutional aspects of the debate. And there are those who say that the framers of the Constitution would likely be horrified by some of what's going on in America today. True or not, the question does come to mind that isn't some of this stuff, especially when it's done on a broad scale, isn't it supposed to be prevented by the Fourth Amendment that prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures without probable cause?
Well, actually, you need to read the amendment carefully. Okay, you and I are all we are all protected against unreasonable search and seizure, and no warrant shall be issued except under probable cause. There are two parts. Not all reasonable searches require a warrant or require probable cause. Anybody who's flown in the last 12 years in America knows that searches are conducted without warrant or probable cause as you're trying to get on an airplane. But I think we'd all agree, as inconvenient as they are, all right, it pretty much is a reasonable search. And that's the magic word. The courts look at what is going on, and based upon the totality of the circumstances available at the time, is what the government doing reasonable in terms of that balance between privacy and liberty and security and safety? Look, Paul, on my own authorities, fully within my own authorities, and I briefed it to the executive branch and to both intelligence oversight committees, but on the afternoon of September 11, 2001, I shifted, as the director of the National Security Agency, what constituted reasonable in some of our collection activities. And so, I mean, honest men can differ, but this is a constant tension within our society. What do the totality of circumstances available at the moment suggest is a reasonable exercise of searching, and what constitutes unreasonable search? Now, Paul, I really have to add, this metadata program, the phone records and so on, and the prison program and the emails, no one is claiming they're illegal. I mean, they're based on law and presidential directives and approved by the court. Now, I fully understand we may want to have a really good discussion as to whether or not they're wise, but they clearly are legal. And one of the problems my old community has, Paul, is this isn't happening in a vacuum. This is happening with all these other things out there in the public domain now. And frankly, I fear government overreach right now based upon other things that are happening within the federal government, whether it's, you know, the byproducts of the Affordable Care Act or warrants against the Associated Press or James Robeson being named a co-conspirator, or frankly, you mentioned I was a Duquesne grad, and frankly, how does the Secretary of Health and Human Services get to redefine what constitutes a Catholic institution? I'm an American too, and I fear government overreach. And so I understand the tension, but I wouldn't quickly jump to the point it's unconstitutional or unlawful. Now we just have to figure out what's wise.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is General Michael Hayden, former director of the CIA and the NSA. Sir, do these intelligence gathering programs actually help uncover terror and financial patterns?
They do. The fall of the money thing has been really, really quite good. And frankly, you know, remember I said earlier, Paul, it's not just terrorism, right? It could be proliferation. It could be the drug trade. It could be money laundering and so on. One of the most remarkable developments in intelligence in the last 10 years or so has been the use of extremely narrowly targeted financial sanctions against individuals in the world who are doing things that would cause us harm. We've got financial sanctions, again, very specifically targeted against Iran, against Syria, from time to time against people in North Korea. And they have proven to be very powerful tools in achieving American policy. Well, that has to be based upon exquisite intelligence as to where these people have their money. Again, it's the follow the money stream. So, you can probably sense I have a certain level of comfort with these activities, knowing full well that anything a government does can be abused. And therefore, it does require careful oversight. And in the case of the intelligence community, the oversight comes not just from within, but from without as well, from the House and Senate intelligence panels.
General Hayden, you are, or at least you were, a supporter of enhanced interrogation techniques. Why is torture an effective way of getting information?
Well, you confuse the question there, Paul, because enhanced interrogation techniques, in the opinion of 3 out of the last 4 attorney generals, did not constitute torture. Now, well, torture is used as a general description is one thing. Torture as a legal term is something quite different.
Okay, well, let's clarify it then. And what would you say, how would you describe, say, 1 or 2 specific enhanced interrogation techniques?
Well, let me bring up the harshest we used. It was waterboarding. I should add that there was no waterboarding while I was the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. And in fact, while I was director of the Central Intelligence Agency, we formally took waterboarding off the table and decided we would not use it going forward. We waterboarded 3 people. The last waterboarding took place in March of 2003. That's 3 Al-Qaeda detainees waterboarded by the Central Intelligence Agency. We also waterboarded 2 of our own lawyers. And before we get to any lawyer jokes out there, that was because these very good people wanted to understand the physical phenomenon of the technique before they offered judgment on it. And, oh, yeah, as part of their survival training, we waterboarded literally tens of thousands of American air crew members in the Air Force and in the Navy as a routine part of their training. When I became the director of CIA, my deputy was a Navy SEAL, and he had been waterboarded in his training as well. And so I'm look, I understand. Well, really good patriotic Americans may object to waterboarding, but we need to be precise with our language here.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, if waterboarding, and correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand it, as most of us understand it, it means you're holding someone against their will underwater until they cannot breathe. And anybody who's been caught underwater or lost their breath and can't get it back knows that that is not a good feeling. So I guess my question is, how is that not torture?
Well, then, I mean, if you're looking at the pod, I don't mean to dwell on this very long. Like I said, three people in the history of the agency and all before I got there. So how is it not, if it's the nature of the act as you're defining it that makes it torture, what do we do to all those American airmen?
Well, some might say that in order to become a Navy SEAL or to ascend to a higher branch of the military, you have to go through some torturous activities or trials and tests.
Quite a different word. But torturous is one thing. Torture is the legal term. You know, we didn't sodomize anybody in their training. We didn't pull their fingernails out in their training. And we didn't do that to these detainees either, because those clearly, objectively, universally agreed were unacceptable forms of behavior. Now, look, you may think waterboarding is an unacceptable form of behavior. I appreciate that. Many of our countrymen do. But then you have to somehow accommodate the fact we did it to tens of thousands of our own as part of training into your thinking. Now, to get to the nub of the case, the three people who waterboarded provided wonderful foreign intelligence on Al-Qaeda. And we did it not because we enjoyed doing it. We did it out of a sense of duty, not enthusiasm, and we did it to get information that ultimately saved American and Allied lives. Here's how I formulate it, Paul. Any one of our countrymen gets to say, I don't like that behavior. I don't want my government doing it. That is a noble expression, and I fully respect it. What you don't get to say is, and besides, it didn't work anyway. It did work.
I want to look at some of the recent revelations involving the NSA. You came to the NSA in 1999 at a time of what has been described as great trouble in the agency. And part of your plan to revitalize the agency was to bring in more outside contractors, which is what Edward Snowden was. If the NSA wasn't introducing more outside contractors, would someone like Snowden have even gotten through the door of the NSA?
Well, keep in mind that someone like Snowden, in fact, it was Snowden himself, who actually was a full-time government employee for the Central Intelligence Agency before he left that and became a contractor and worked for NSA. And so I think the important distinction here, Paul, is not whether it's a blue badger or a green badger. That's the Washington way we describe government employees, blue, and contractors, green. It's not whether he was a blue or a green badger. It's whether or not that human being should have had access to U.S. government secrets. And the fact that he was a contractor should not in any way have lowered the bar for his eligibility to have access to that kind of information. And I have to add, although he worked for Booz Allen, the entity that cleared him and said he was suitable to protect this kind of information wasn't Booz Allen. It was the United States government.
Some say that Snowden has done a service for America by exposing some of the more unsavory things that the NSA was doing, or what is unsavory in the view of some, certainly critics of the NSA. What do you say to that?
Well, first of all, unsavory is okay because unsavory represents personal taste. What he didn't do was to reveal anything illegal. And that's a really important distinction. Now, even Jim Clapper, the current director of National Intelligence, Jim has said this has triggered, I actually think it's accelerated, a debate we were already going to have about what is it you want your intelligence agencies to do to protect you? What is it will you allow your intelligence agencies to do to protect you in this new world? But I am very reluctant to give Mr. Snowden credit. You said he went from contractor to exile. My phrase is he went from contractor to defector. And if I can kind of make a macro judgment as to whether he was a good thing or a bad thing, I'd simply point out that right now, as we speak, the levees on Lake Pontchartrain down in New Orleans are the best they've been in more than a century.
In light of
Katrina was a really bad event.
In light of Snowden, does the NSA need to be restructured?
I think what we're going to see, not so much a restructuring within NSA, but, you know, the director of NSA is also the commander of U.S. Cyber Command. Those are two very, very demanding jobs. And I think one of the practical effects of these disclosures, Paul, is when General Alexander leaves early next spring, they'll probably separate those two tasks, bring two talented people in, and let each of them focus on the specific job of director of NSA and commander of Cyber Command.
We are very, very tight on time, sir, but I wanted to ask you about the NSA needing to collect communications of allied leaders like German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Why would the U.S. need to do that?
Because the National Security Agency collects foreign intelligence, and the intentions of foreign leaders is a very, very important part of that foreign intelligence. And Angela Merkel is a very good friend of the United States, and if we were doing that, my sense of our real crime is not that we may or may not have been doing it, but that we failed to keep it a secret and thereby embarrassed a very, very good friend. But when you get to the point of why do you listen to some people in the world, let's talk about Angela Merkel's predecessor. Let's talk about Gerhard Schroeder. And let's skip over the part where he was working with Jacques Chirac and Vladimir Putin to stymie U.S. policy in Iraq in 2002 and 2003. Let's just give them that one as an honest difference of policy. Let's fast forward to the end of his chancellorship when, shortly before leaving government, he secured a 1 billion euro loan for Nord Stream, which is a Russian gas company under the Russian gas oligarchy Gazprom. And then shortly after leaving the German government, accepted a very lucrative position on the board of directors of that institution. Now, I actually think a legitimate foreign intelligence question on the part of the United States would be, is that enlightened statecraft or something different? And therefore, the intentions of leaders, even leaders of some friendly countries, from time to time are really legitimate foreign intelligence questions. Paul, yesterday, CIA released almost all of the intelligence it had prepared for the Camp David Accords. Remember that? Sadat,
right.
Begin, and President Carter? And they actually have a quote in there from President Carter saying, hey, what I need to know is I need to know these leaders' personal thoughts. I need to know personally what they think of one another. I need to know personally what they think of me. Well, how do you think we get that stuff? Well, one way is we actually listen to their personal communications.
General Michael Hayden is former director of the Central Intelligence Agency and the National Security Agency. He is appearing in Pittsburgh to take part in a World Affairs Council public policy discussion and luncheon on Monday, November 18th at noon at the Duquesne Club. General Hayden, it has been an honor speaking with you. Thank you so much for taking time to join us here on Essential Pittsburgh.
No, my pleasure, Paul, and thanks for the good and tough questions.
You're welcome, sir. Coming up, former Labor Secretary Robert Reich discusses his documentary, Inequality for All. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.